It's time for Twig This Week at Google. The Google glasses are here, and they're real. We'll take a look at what that might be. Larry Page, after he celebrates his first year as CEO of Google, we'll give him a report card. And, yes, we'll talk about the jobs bill. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Google is provided by Cachefly. CacheFly.com.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 141, recorded April 4th, 2012. A carrot-shaped stick. This Week in Google is brought to you by Stamps.com. Your time is valuable. Don't waste another minute waiting in line at the post office. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage the instant you need it, using your own computer and printer. To get my special offer, go to Stamps.com now. Click on the radio microphone and enter Twig. Stamps.com, offer code Twig. And by Ford, featuring voice-activated Sync App Link. Now you can control select smartphone apps with your voice, helping keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Learn more about the technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at Ford.com/technology. It's time for This Week in Google, the show that covers anything we damn well want to cover. How about that? Right? Just because it says Google in the name doesn't mean there's something besides Google inside. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Gina Trapani, founding editor of Life Hacker, author of Think Up, blogger at smarterware.org, and all around genial good person and Brooklynite.
Hello, Gina.
Hello.
Welcome.
I'm excited to talk about glasses.
Glasses.
Let's get through the intro first.
They're half full.
They are half full. Today they're half full.
Mr. Jeff Jarvis, my friends, of the City University of New York, where he teaches the new journalism to young children. He's also a blogger at BuzzMachine.com and author of many great books like What Would Google Do in his latest Public Parts.
Thank you for the plugs, as always.
Today wearing leather so he won't moire. I learned that term on Glee. And leather, I mean. And then we got all the way over to the right. We got Mr. Matthew Ingram of GigaOhm, GigaOhm.com. And no one knows why his Twitter handle is Matthew I. I guess it's his name. For a while, I thought it was Matt Huey. Hey, Matthew. Frozen solid. He's turned to stone. Stop looking at your wife and keep going forward. He's a pillar of salt. All right, let's.
Boxing gloves. We're in a fighting mood today.
I'm feisty today. I've been fighting with. That's because I've been fighting with my Galaxy tablet that I haven't turned. It's my fault. I haven't turned it on in a year, and it's feeling left out. But I wanted to show you something hot and new that requires Honeycomber later on a tablet. So I'm going to defer to you, Gina, because you were excited about talking about the glasses that we're all going to get at Google I.O.
Oh, from your lips to Google PR.
We'll all be stumbling around, not being able to see anything.
Yes, Google I.O. is going to be such a train wreck because everybody's going to be looking like this or looking like this. I swear to God, I thought this was a hoax when we first heard about it. But now, no less authority than Nick Bilton in the freaking New York Times says Google is testing these glasses.
Well, I think it's the one who broke the story initially.
Yeah.
I remember. Yeah.
Now, these photos come from Google, so this is it. This
are
is the real.
Are we allowed to play the video, or will we get banned on Earth?
Yeah, let's play it. I've got it here.
We should mention this. We should mention this. That last week, we aired what I thought was a great promotional video, for Google and its self-driving cars. It was
not
a great
that it needs any promotion.
It was a great video, and it came from Google as promotional. They yanked us off YouTube immediately. Content removed at request of Google.
The robots did.
Well, I think it was the robots because we immediately
Google
appealed.
Is a robot, Gina?
Well, that's true.
Yeah. It's the same thing.
Python Hi, pulled everyone. Us. Hey, welcome back, Matthew. So we appealed it. So here's how it works, just for those who don't know. So there is a automated content filter, which, by the way,
is totally being gamed, because we have shows that I get flagged all the time for violating content from Brazilian TV companies that we've never aired any content from. So I think these companies are gaming the content filter, saying, yes, I will own anything that has anything in it that says zooby zooby zoo. And then what happens is, but don't worry, don't pull it down. Just put our ads in it. It's a way of third parties getting ads in our content by gaming Google's content filter. This is my thesis.
Wow.
Because I'm telling you, I get requests, I get these notices all the time. Well, don't worry, not your content's not going to be pulled down. We're just going to put ads on it. We might put ads on it. So that's a YouTube thing that is already bugging me. So this time they pulled it down. Now, the way it works, it's automated. So if you're a content creator, you tell Google, here's, I guess, the thumbprint, right? The fingerprint of our content somehow. And if you see this, do something. And you're given a number of choices. You can say, yank it. You can say, put our ads on it. Or something like put ads on it or buy this product, buy this song. So you have a choice. Google, in this case, yanked it. Now, the next step is for the people who put the video up in the first place, to appeal. So there's a form. You fill out a form saying, no. And there's a couple of things. We own this content. That's wrong. Is there a fair use exemption? Is there actually a checkbox that says, no, we say that we have the right to do this? I don't think there is, but that's our assertion is we're a news organization.
Says yes.
There is? Okay. Tom, who does this pretty much all the time, knows. Alex Gumpel and our staff filled this out, and they immediately put it back. Now, it's not been taken down again. What happens is a human then reviews it. And at that point, the human says, no, that's a violation. It'll get pulled down again. Now there's a long 10-day appeal process that is much more complicated.
What content does Google have that it possibly wants to protect under copyright? Everything Google puts online is promotional.
Well, that's why. Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, and I'll pass this along to anybody who does a podcast, the fingerprinting tool doesn't work very well. So if you don't make the video full screen, if you just show it in context on the YouTube screen, apparently it just doesn't even know. So that was one mistake I made. I wanted to go full screen on that great video. So I did it. And I figured, well, I didn't look at the license, but how could Google complain that we're playing a promotional video on a show about Google?
So just do Mystery Science Theater 3000 and you can show anything.
Well, but that's the other side of it is now this is kind of a fair use provision, which means it's not, you have to test it in court. It's a defense. It's not proactive. So it doesn't protect you until somebody says no, and then you have to go to court.
As Larry Lessig says, it's the right to hire a lawyer.
Oh, thank you. Thanks, Congress. But that's our assertion, is that we're a news organization and we are protected not to use it as a production value, but in the coverage of this news to show clips. You see it all the time on television, right? That's normal. But we're not, nobody knows who the hell Twig is, and so we get pulled all the time. Anyway, so having said all this, here's a little test.
Now we're going to do it again.
Let's do it again, and let's go full screen. Well, we don't have to.
Really? Okay.
Is, if they pull it down, it costs us money because that's a day's worth of impressions, even if we react right away, that we lose. So, yeah, make it be in the window.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah, then your audience.
Then we can talk about this.
Okay, here we go.
Project Glass, one day we believe technology should work for you to be there when you need it. So I'm going to narrate because there's people listening on audio. There's a guy in flip-flops, just got up, looking at his desk, making some coffee. And now he's looking through glasses that tell him what he has to do today. What? He's looking out the window. It says 58 degrees with a chance of rain. He's eating a sandwich, and his friend, Ev Williams, says, want to meet up today? And he talks back to him. Says, meet me in Strand Books. And it says, sent. And then he goes back to his sandwich. All of this through his eyes. You're seeing out his... These are the glasses. It's augmented reality.
Oh,
Subway
man,
service
really?
Suspended before he even goes down the stairs. So it gives him a walking route. And he's going to take that route from Google Maps. Walk right into the middle of the street.
Hey there, little guy.
There's some puppies.
I'm surprised it didn't tell him the breed of the dog.
That dog. Now this is interesting. He's looking at a poster for a Monsieur Gaino concert. Is that a real person? And he's going to book tickets. Just like that. He's in a bookstore and it's showing him where to go.
Oh, yes. This is it.
Now he's learning to play the ukulele.
Is Paul here yet?
He's talking to himself.
If he had really done that, he would have gotten the book out. He would have seen the barcode. And he would have found the cheaper price at another store.
Yeah, right. Paul's 402 feet away. Dude, there's Paul.
No facial recognition. Sure. No, this is Paul.
Yeah.
Hey, just a jerk. None of that.
He's loading the taco truck to see if it's okay. He's checking in on...
Mud truck, Leo. This is New York. Truck.
What is mud? Coffee?
Coffee.
See you, dude.
Is he getting coffee? What do you call it? Coffee light?
Whoa.
Light and sweet.
Cool. Light and sweet.
Take a photo of this.
He's going to take a photo with his glasses.
Share it to my circles.
Sharing it to his circles, because he's the last person still using Google Plus.
Oh, I'm running late.
Ooh.
Music.
That'll get you pulled off YouTube.
Wait a minute. Jessica wants to talk.
Hi.
Drop everything.
Hey.
He's actually seeing video of Jessica while he... Apparently he's contemplating suicide, but Jessica's going to... Is he going to jump? Oh, he's learning the ukulele and jumping. And he's playing the Google theme on his ukulele. He's a fast learner. And she thinks it's adorable. g.co/projectglass. There, I gave him even a promotional plug. So this
we
is...
We want.
In that video, they never show the glasses. But this is what the picture in the Times is of the glasses. These don't look like the Oakleys that we thought they were. In fact, they look particularly dorky.
Yeah, too.
She looks like 7 of 9.
It's like a half of Jordy LaForge's visor, you know, kind of on one side of your
face. Very Borgish. What the hell? So, anyway, go ahead.
They're not as bad as I thought. They're not as bad as they could have been, style-wise. I don't like that there's only one side that has the camera, you know, the bit of hardware that's required to have the camera and all that.
Because I want our audience to imagine that we're all of us on the show now are wearing them, though.
We're all wearing them.
Yeah. We soon will be.
So, and by the way, doesn't work with an iPhone, I presume. You have to have an Android phone. That's where all of this power is coming from. The glasses can stream information to the lenses and allow the wearer to send and receive messages through voice command. There's a built-in camera to record video and take pictures. And there you go. I want... Project Glass. They also say it could hypothetically become Project Contact Lens. People are building... not Google, but Nick does. He quotes a professor at the University of Washington who specializes in... Well, you know why. Bio-nanotechnology. Thanks to the miracles of bio-nanotechnology... Which is the fusion of tiny technologies
and
biology.
Well, then skip the lens. Hardwire straight in. Where's the USB port up here? I missed it somewhere.
Here's Professor Parez's lens. It's you put that in your eye and shove it. Smoke it. Jesus. Whatever it is. So these are pretty, you know, they're interesting.
These are cool. I mean, the chat room said, come on. The reality is I'm dying to try this out. I would buy these in a second if I could. And I really hope that they're going to be at Google I.O.
Wouldn't that
at
be
least,
awesome?
If not the giveaway, then at least a couple of prototypes that people can try out, you know, on the floor.
What would you pay, Gina?
At least as much as you paid for your phone, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would think so. Yeah. So, Leo, you're saying that it connects to your phone, so it's like Bluetooth connection to
That's
your phone.
That's my understanding,
Yeah.
It makes sense. You're not going to put all the CPU in there. And by the way, you might want to sell some Android phones while you're at it.
Well, right. Yeah, that makes sense. I would probably pay as much as my phone, although I'm a little crazy. I don't know if a regular consumer would.
I'd pay $1,000 for these. Are you kidding?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'd pay $1,000.
The issue is not the cost. $1,000? Well, I'm made of money, Matthew.
But Gina, would you wear them all the time? Or would you just try them out now and then?
Well, I don't know. I really would have to try them to see how they really work in real life. I mean, you know, you have to think about kind of remember the Google TV demo problem. I mean, like, you know, it's like in theory, this looks really
That's
great.
That's exactly
but
was going to be
these
my
glasses,
point.
That demo video is amazing, right. But are they really going to work? Yeah.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
Of course not.
Well, you know.
And that's totally the issue. It's not the price.
Right. Yeah.
Does it work?
I wonder, so you go to the subway entrance, you know, and there's just a spinning colored ball or whatever. You're waiting for it to tell you, should I get on the subway or not?
Right.
This is going to change the way we build cities.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of it has to do with your data connection, whether or not you're in a city where it's going to recognize the subway that you're getting on, or if you even take the subway, if all your friends actually do share their location on Google Latitude down to the foot, so I can say, where is my friend? I found it wonderfully sort of charming and ironic that the demo video was of this guy going to a bookstore to buy a book on how to
play the ukulele.
You know, and it wasn't just like, hey, download a book to my Android phone from the Google Play Market on how to play a ukulele. But, you know, I'm really interested in what the experience is for my eyeballs to focus in on the heads-up display versus what I'm trying to look at. And a lot of people brought up the awkwardness of just speaking into a device, you know, like
talking. But we've done that. Wait a minute, though. I thought it was crazy. Everybody's wearing these little Bluetooth things, and you see crazy people talking. And we got pretty used to it, didn't we?
Yeah, we got used to it. But come on, everybody might make fun of those people. Secretly.
Well, yeah, but if you're a Bluetooth guy, you don't care.
Right, you're right.
You're busy driving your cab.
Hawaii Dave in our chat room said something I think that's kind of telling. I'd buy it if it came from Apple. Right? Right? Isn't that the case?
Good point.
Is that because Google has a reputation for putting out half-baked products that break and get into boot loops 2 weeks later?
No. I'd buy it if it came from, you know, if it came from Apple, would, you know, then it'd be at least to be kind of work.
Well, and the other part of it is that, especially when these first get released, people are going to notice them. They look different. They look a little weird. You're going to spend most of your time explaining what's on your face, you know, maybe than actually getting value out of them. So, but do I love to fantasize about a world where everybody has one of these and it's just kind of a normal way of interacting? Absolutely.
I think if somebody asks you, say, they're my Google glasses, they're my Google goggles. And then and leave it at that. And I don't think now my question is, and I'm trying to understand this. I see the guy's eye. How does this work? Are you looking up through the, I don't understand.
No, I think you look at the video. It was just, it's projected on.
So is it projecting this into my retina?
Yeah. Into your eye.
And then, so I'm looking straight ahead. It's a heads up display.
Right. Is it projecting in your eye or is it reflective on the glasses?
So he's looking at stuff. Well, this is bogus. It's not going to look
like this.
Of course. But that looks like
look at that. I mean, that's an overlay over his, you know.
But if you look at these glasses, they're not looking through the glasses at me. They're looking at me.
I think you're looking at a little, well, I don't know. The old ones, you had literally a little screen up here.
Right. These, in neither case.
Look at that little thing that's over her eye. I don't know that you're not looking at a little screen up there.
So you would look up to see it?
Yeah, it looks like
the New York Times article makes it sound like it's projecting information on a screen.
Yeah, I think it's a little screen. You can't really set it in your eye.
You can actually, but I'll bet you $10 if you describe that to somebody, they wouldn't be, you know,
creepy.
Optimistic about trying it out. It beams it right into your retina.
Well, as long as it's not doing it with a laser.
I mean, you notice that things go kind of blurry in the background when in this video. I realize that this demo video is just a demo, but it looks as if you have to focus on the screen.
You have to purposely focus
on the screen.
That's exactly what the Times article says it's not. They're saying it's a well-designed pair of wraparound glasses with a clear display that sits above the eye. The glasses can stream information to the lenses. I don't see any
lenses.
There's
only one lens.
Maybe that's what's really weird looking is you're wearing glasses that actually don't have a lens. They have a Borg piece.
Well, I'll have to.
A Borg piece is probably good.
I am Borg. I am part human, part machine. Which part would you like to speak to today?
You know, the part I liked the best was where you could just take a picture.
Yeah.
Because I know I see lots of things I want to take a picture of, and then I have to get my phone out, and then I have to, you know, it'd be nice to just be able to look at something and say, take a picture.
By voice command, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how good that camera is.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's no bigger than the camera anywhere. I mean, it could be a very good camera.
It could be.
So the camera is you have a combination of geo data and camera data, right? It's like your own self-driving car, except you have feet still, right? So it's combining the two.
Mm-hmm. The question is, do you want to be 1.0 of 9 or 0.01 of 9? I'll wait till it's 7, 8, 10. Yeah. Then
Never
once it's 7,
version.
It'll be safe. That's 7.
Never buy 1.0 of anything.
I'm version 1.0 of 9. You know what? We should get Jerry Ryan on the show. Ask her what she would do.
Have you ever heard of Steve Mann, the University of Toronto professor, the cyborg?
Yeah, he was at MIT, right? He was the guy who walked around all the time. Now he's at Toronto.
Yeah, he had, when he first started, he had this huge headset and a giant backpack, and it weighed about 100 pounds. And then eventually it was just basically glasses like that.
Wow. Matthew Ingram is here from GigaOhm. We love GigaOhm, GigaOhm.com. What's your beat, Matthew? Do you just get to cover anything you feel like?
My beat is the internet.
The internet. Yeah. I'm in charge of the internet, says Matthew.
I guess, you know, media is my thing.
No, come on.
But everything's media, right?
Anything. You cover anything.
Yeah. Everything and nothing. There's no mediators left. There is no media.
If it doesn't drop when you break it, it's part of my beat. If it doesn't break when you drop it.
I like drop when you break it.
Yeah, I like that too.
So is Jeff Jarvis. So is Gina Trapani. We're going to talk about Larry Page and his one-year anniversary as CEO. What's the report card? That's next. But first, let's tell you how you never have to go to the post office again. Now, I'm not talking forever stamps. I'm talking bringing the post office to your desk. So that everything you need to do, you can do right here with your computer and your printer. It's stamps.com, Mac or PC. It lets you print real U.S. postage for a letter, a package, anything, a postcard. You've got a USB scale that goes right into the computer, so you drop the thing on the scale, and it's always exactly right. If you're mailing internationally, you know what a hassle that is. If you want to mail something to England, you have to go to the post office. They get the international postage. You got to fill out forms. Stamps.com does it for you. You don't have to go to the post office. In fact, there's nothing you can do at the post office you can't do at your desk with Stamps.com. Even, you know, post 9/11, I tried this. You can't mail a package more than 13 ounces in a mailbox because they're worried about whatever. You can with Stamps.com. In fact, because it's got an indicia on it, so there's identity information, so it's, you know, they're comfortable. It's got a barcode on. They're comfortable with that. So, in fact, the mail carrier comes to you and take anything you want, 100-pound packet, no problem. Yeah, we trust you. You're using stamps.com. You also get discounts you cannot get anywhere else. The post office will not give you up to 21% on express mail, up to 15% off on priority mail. No, but stamps.com will. So, all right. So, look, this is cool. You don't need special ink. You don't need a postage meter. Get rid of the postage meter. You just need stamps.com, a computer and a printer. You get the scale. I get a deal. Now, see right there on the page at stamps.com, it says $80. Forget that. Click the microphone up at the top there. Don't do the $80 deal. And put TWIG, T-W-I-G. Eileen's going to do it right now. I've convinced her. And then look what you get. First of all, a lovely picture of me. No. Aw. Used to get a picture of me. Now all you get is a $110 bonus offer, including $55 free postage and the scale. All you have to do is pay for your shipping and handling. It's a couple of bucks. And a month of stamps.com. This is a great deal. $55 in free postage. Come on. That's going to get you some, that's going to get you a couple of months of postage right there. If you're an eBay seller, this is great. An Amazon seller, it's great. Stamps.com. Click the, you know, funny looking microphone in the upper right hand corner. Use the offer code TWIG for $110 no risk trial, including the scale and $55 free postage. Stamps.com. Don't put it off. I cannot promise you how long this is going to last. You got to do it. Do not delay. And I'm telling you, you'll thank me. Because I think, you know, they're changing the price on the stamps soon, and they're closing post. Two out of the three post offices in Petaluma are slated for closing.
In June, I run, if anybody's interested in this, I helped organize a conference in Washington called Postal Vision 2020.
You're kidding.
No, all because some guy named John Callen read What Would Google Do and said, you know, he was at a conference where somebody asked the head of the regulatory commission in the U.S., what would Google do if they owned the post office?
Oh, how interesting.
Well, they'd give everybody a computer and a printer. And he thought that they'd read the book. They hadn't, so he gave him a copy. And I find it so fascinating. It's such a disrupted industry on the one hand. On the other hand, it's disrupting retail on the parcel end.
Right.
And so if anybody's fascinated with this, as I am, there's huge, I think, disruptive entrepreneurial opportunities in this area. Postal Vision 2020, I'm not making any money off of it, but it's, I just find it to be a fascinating topic.
It's this June.
This June.
Cool. I think, actually, it is a very interesting area.
It really actually is. You know, because when you realize how much of the Postal Service is subsidized by first class and by the notion of, number one, a letter, what's that? And then number two, bills.
Right. You
take
have
those
to get
away.
Right.
Right. Take that high, the high.
All I get
cost
now
away.
Is junk mail. It's the only thing I get in the mail.
Right. And so that's essentially been subsidized by first class.
And
first
I don't want to do that. And there's no first class anymore.
Right. So the economics of the Postal Department, all of that infrastructure that they have, that they don't really, you know, need anymore. So what do? Could you put post offices in Walgreens?
Put it on your desk. You just said it. Computer printer.
Bingo. Bingo.
You don't need to put it anywhere.
If the Postal Department gave you a constant discount to use stamps.com, not to plug the sponsor, to use them.
They do, by the way.
Right. I mean, so the constant discount, at some point you're going to change the economics, so that why would you go to the post office?
The value of the post office is you've got a bunch of people running around in little trucks. If they could figure out how to capitalize on that, get rid of everything else. But they could be delivering ice cream. Think about that. Or you get the Schwann guy to start delivering mail. Either way, one or the other.
Milkman. Bring back the milkman. You get the occasional letter.
Oh, man. But you knew the milkman was in trouble when they started adding, like, products. Like, they started doing milk shampoo. That was when you knew there must be a problem in the fundamental economics of getting up in the morning and delivering milk to people. I think the post office is mandated by the Constitution. You're right. We need a constitutional amendment to get rid of it. But they can cut it back.
You can have universal service other ways. You could you could subsidize, UPS.
Right.
Not to go off on this week in going postal.
Right. Hey, I like it.
That's a good title.
Yeah. Twip. So Larry Page. What was the actual date that he became? He's 1 year now, right? April 4th, right? So this is today is the anniversary. I hope they give him a cake or something. He replaced, it's hard to believe it's been a year that he replaced Eric Schmidt as CEO of Google. What kind of year has it been? Matthew, what grade would we give Larry Page in his first year as the CEO?
That's a good one. I'd have to say probably in the B+ range. I mean,
not perfect, huh?
No. And I think, there's some things he's done that I think some people would give high marks to, like, say, streamlining things, shutting down lots of products, lots of experiments, the labs and so on, that, I kind of go back and forth on that. Is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? I actually think, you could argue it's good that he streamlined the company and focused it and so on. But at the same time, I think a lot of those things were part of what made Google special, like Google Glasses or the Google Art Project.
I agree that and Stephen Levy's got a good article in Wired about this. The pull quote is, when I asked Larry last September what he thought was Google's threat, the answer was out of his mouth before I even finished the query. Google, he said. The biggest threat to Google is Google. You agree, Jeff?
Yeah, in fact, Eric Schmidt gave the same answer when I asked him that. So that's one area where they were in alignment. And I think that's why they had the management change. Is that the management structure, and they said this at the time, it fulfilled its purpose for a while, but they were standing in the way of progress and focus and so on. And so clearly that they knew they had to focus. That's why Larry has been so perhaps maniacal about focus. The hard part I have in judging his reign so far is separating out those things that came before it. Right, so Buzz and the Buzz screw up, I think, was a screw up before, or certainly started before he was solely in charge. We can get back into the argument about whether they really screwed up privacy or not. I don't think they have, I agree with Matthew. I'd say it's B+ because we're not even at the midterm yet. We're just barely into the first marking period.
It's a thank you, Professor.
I'll finish his homework.
It's a mixed bag because on the one hand, I think you could say that he's done some good stuff focusing the company, but this has been the year that Google has suffered its biggest black marks of all, right, Gina?
It is. And a lot of people would say that they're, I mean, what's the biggest product launch that Google's had in the past year? I mean, Google Plus.
Plus.
Plus. Yeah. And there's a lot, that's a mixed bag. You know, so you could argue that that's that the Google Plus is the long-term play, and that the plusification of everything is Google, you know, moving the, you know, shifting the entire company toward being more social, and that, you know, even though people don't love it right at the moment, they will in the long term. So he's making the right decisions. At the same time, you can make the argument that Google Plus was not a spectacular product that changed lives right away. You know, that answer to that question, you know, what's Google's biggest challenge? Google. It's a good answer, but it also seems a little insular to me. I think maybe an honest answer would have included things like Facebook and Twitter. I mean, I think that feeling is certainly
that's a good point
within the company.
Yeah,
that there. I mean, obviously, Google Plus was a response to feeling like Facebook was dominating an area that Google couldn't or didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that I think a B plus is fair. Is a fair mark for him. I think the focus on particular products, trimming the fat, all good things. At the same time, I mean, you know, somebody said, I forget, I mean, maybe it was Adam from Lifehacker said on Twitter that the April Fool's gags that Google did this past weekend, I mean, were some of the best product announcements they've had in a really long time. And, you know, that says something.
It was kind of stunning. We ran down all the Google April Fool's jokes on Twitter. It made me feel like, what are they doing? This seems like more energy was put into those April Fool's jokes than they put into everything else they've done all year.
Yeah. Yes, I'm really looking forward to I.O. I think that Google Glasses is really cool. I'm interested to see things like Google Drive finally kind of come to fruition. And I'm not anti-Google Plus. I just don't think that Google Plus was the big blockbuster that things like Gmail and Maps were kind of back in the day.
It's starting to look like a flop. I think it's starting.
Yeah, I mean, and it is. It depends on where you look at it. It's not clear, though.
No.
You know,
no, it's not. It's not. And I think it's. Listen, they're clumsy with design. They're clumsy with announcements. And you know, I'm hesitant to say that we need a slicker Google, but we do. You just said that, right? All of the product announcements done for April Fool's were much slicker than Google normally does things. Google could get too slick. Part of what we like about it is that it's not fully slick. But let's just say that, yes, it needs to be slicker. And that's true in all of these areas. You know, Google Plus, I still think, has the essence of something. And I don't think that it is the anti-Facebook. I've made this argument 100 times on the show, but it's signal generation. And I say that Google Plus and Android are about, in terms of their product value, in terms of separate from monetary value, product value are about bringing new data, new signals about people and content to Google. And that Google can measure the success or failure of Google Plus differently. Is it the new Facebook? No, it's never going to be that. I'll fully concede that, no problem. But does Google learn a lot from Google Plus? Does it bring new services, which they, again, to search, they make, you know, clumsily designed, badly announced, badly let out? But is there potential there? I think it's way too soon to call it a flop.
But, you know, Jeff, it feels to me like even your description sort of feels to me like, I know, and I've said this before, I know what Google is getting out of Google Plus, right? I know they're getting lots of my data. I know they're probably triangulating all sorts of things about me and my demographic or whatever. But so I sort of see what they're getting in terms of pulling in information. I don't actually see what I get out of it yet.
What I get, and you know, there's people who are denizens of it and like it. What I'm getting very simply is quality conversation. I get a better conversation on Google Plus than I get in my blog, which is mainly people who don't like me. And Twitter, which is, hey, look, there's a fight over there, which I'm really sick of. You know, there's other places where, you know, Hacker News
Slashdot
or Reddit, where you might have conversations you like. Well, and now, but here's the huge caveat. Yes, I'm on the recommended list, and I just looked just now. This should be my number of the day.
No, go ahead and use it. We'll get another number for you.
I got one. No, because I just saw it just now. I just passed 1 million alleged followers on Google Plus. Now,
I think you can make the case, though, that suggested user list is a sign of a problem. Because I'm not on the suggested user list, and I'm totally stalled out at 287,000.
Yes, I agree with that. And the thing about it is that it's also rather meaningless. I'm not in conversations with people who I basically don't know. I'm in conversations with people who really do truly follow.
Right.
And so I don't know how the algorithm's working and how much I'm really shown to people. I don't think it's much. So, yeah, I think that kind of absurdity of the list and that number is ridiculous. But I just go back to the bottom line for me, Matthew. I get good quality conversations out of Google Plus, and it depends on who you follow.
I was going to say, I think that like the we're defining participating on Google Plus, participating in the network the same way we define participating on Facebook or Twitter. And I think that it's actually a lot more than that. I think that just clicking, you know, plus one on a link in your search results or checking in on Google Latitude on Android or, you know, I don't know, clicking on somebody's circle information in your contacts. I think because Google Plus, like little bits of Google Plus are going to be part of every single Google product, that in a lot of ways you're giving them signals and you're using the network without going to Google, you know, plus.google.com and writing a post, right? Like that's a very active way to participate, but there are going to be very passive ways to participate, especially when you have, sorry, Jeff, this is your number. When you have more than 50% of smartphones or Android phones, what you're signed into your Google account already, you're signed into your Plus account. Your Google account is your Plus account, basically. So, you know, saying, hey, I'm at this great taco truck, check me in, is a way to sort of participate. Yeah. Plus, especially with the privacy policy consolidation. So like I get it. Like if I don't go to Google, I don't go to Google Plus. I don't write a whole lot on Google Plus. Really, I talk about Google because I know that that's my highest chances for Google employees to see what I have to say about Google is there on Plus. I'm still participating in the network in a lot of ways just by using all the different products because Google Plus is Google.
Right. I totally use myself as a measure, and that's the only way I can ever do anything. And I just notice I just don't really feel the urge to go to Google Plus. I used to check it every day. It was my homepage. Still is my homepage, but I just don't feel the urge to check it that much.
What Gina just said. I think it's now tie in, Gina, what you just said to the demo video we watched of the glasses.
Yeah, I mean that was all Google Plus going on there. A lot of it.
And there's no web page. There's no tech stuff. There's no search. Right. There's the results of all that.
Right.
You're at a much higher layer of the world and technology connected. And, you know, if let's give Google credit for this. Let's assume they and Mark Zuckerberg think highly strategically and that they're not worried about, indeed, this quarter, even in Google+. They've got to look at it and say, what's the world going to look like in 2-3 years even? And what competencies, expertise, services, data are we going to have to survive when we get there? And I think that's the context in which you have to judge Google Plus. Now, none of that is to say that Google Plus is perfect, brilliant, couldn't screw up, couldn't die. All that's true. All that's absolutely true. But I think it's a big mistake to think of it just in terms of going on to it to Facebook. I think Gina's way right about this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I listen totally to Spotify, agree. And I'm sharing what songs I'm playing to Facebook automatically, right? That whole frictionless sharing thing, that's what Google Plus is doing. And I think we're just going to see a lot more of that. I mean, that was a hangout. The chat with his girlfriend and the video was a hangout. The checking his friend's location. So, you know, I think for all the people that say, oh, Google Plus is a failure because I don't go to plus.google.com and interact with my friends there, aren't taking all that other activity into account.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the problem with, you know, everybody wants to measure the numbers. You know, part of the problem is a lot of people are engaging through Google Plus or with Google Plus by doing those other things that you mentioned. They're never actually going there, but they're still, you know, content is flowing in and out.
Right. Which means it's not a successful social network in that it's foreground, but as you said, Matthew, it's very successful for Google in collecting signals. It's and a, you know, background I wonder, social network.
Kevin Marks and I were talking about this. Why doesn't Google have more API access to Google Plus? I mean,
it would be a big difference.
I would contribute a huge amount to that network through other tools that I'm using already, like TweetDeck or whatever. Why
precisely?
Don't they do that?
Well, you know, they don't get my photos because I use Instagram or Path, and it goes to Facebook. They get all my photos.
Right.
It goes to Flickr or
I mean, they're the argument, company.
Why don't they have a right API, Gina? That is crazy. Go ahead.
I don't know. It's been a long time. I'm hoping that's going to be announced at I.O.
That's
crazy. I'm not sure why it's taken so long.
Vic has said it is his fault. And the reason it's his fault, the argument that he gives, is very simply that he doesn't want... And, you know, Facebook hates it that people put their Twitter feed onto Facebook.
They shouldn't.
Well, but they do. And you know, when I...
Why do they hate it? Because they're not going to... See ads on Facebook.
Too much noise, I guess.
Well, Yeah, you're not going to Facebook. You're putting in noise. You're not really part of it.
You're enriching the content. It's like...
But if Google wants signals from people, APIs.
I agree with that, Matthew, but I think there are two things. One, remember Buzz when...
Well, Buzz got bad. Yeah.
Well, but we just put our Twitter in there because we weren't into it. Right. That's all it becomes. And don't forget, Google's at a precious moment now when people like you are saying, it's over. So if people just make it a repository for a whole bunch of automated feeds, that will kill it.
I go back to Facebook all the time. I post pictures there through Path and Instagram, and I go back to check the comments and look at the engagement. So Facebook becomes, in a way, the Path and Instagram aren't, a form of interaction around the stuff that I post.
They're in a better position to do that. And I actually go to Facebook a lot less than I go to Google Plus.
Okay. No, so it's just me then.
It's just I'm the weird one here.
Larry Page gave an interview to Business Week yesterday, and they asked him, and he said, he's very happy with the success of Android, Chrome, YouTube. Long-term bets we've made, they've been very successful. All of those things have continued to grow like crazy. We made a more recent one, which is Google Plus, and that's a long-term bet as well. We're not even a year into that, and it's going very well, much better than I expected. There are various worries that people have, and we'll address those, but we have a really good start. I have over 2 million followers now on Google Plus, says Larry Page. A number of other people are even ahead of me, and that's with real engagement. So I'm very happy.
Last time was Larry posted.
He doesn't get engagement. Yeah, come on, Larry.
No, that's a little disingenuous.
That's totally disingenuous. He doesn't post.
Yeah, there's no engagement.
So I'm very happy with the growth of the core Google Plus network. It's interesting, that phrase, core Google Plus network. What does that mean? That means when you go to Google Plus, right?
The site. Yeah.
The site. It doesn't mean tomorrow it's going to be bigger than any other social network out there. That's not realistic, but it's growing faster, I think, than other services had, and I'm very happy with that. So he's making the distinction between the core, which is the page, and all the other stuff, which is clearly working. You know, every time I go somewhere, Latitude automatically checks me in and feeds that to Google Plus and, you know, as a result to Google. So all those other services, I think, are working.
And, you know, plus one button is everywhere.
Plus one's everywhere, yeah.
When they launch third-party comments, just think about this. How fast will you integrate Google comments, Google Plus comments on your blog if you know that those comments will affect your search rank? Kind of the same thing as the authorship did.
No one disagrees that they have the big stick.
They do. Absolutely.
It's a carrot, actually.
they get those. It's a carrot
shaped like a stick.
It's a stick-shaped carrot. They have, that's what's going to, they're basically force feeding people Google Plus.
They're encouraging.
That's awful. Oh, Leo.
I don't know if it's force feeding. I mean, I happily claim my authorship on my websites now. I mean, I know it's going to show up in the, you know, N plus one things.
Okay, so you're happy to be force fed.
I mean,
you want to show up better on Google. I'm saying they're using their cloud and search to encourage you.
Well, that's the carrot. They're force feeding you carrots.
That's fine. Yes, it's part of an SEO checklist, basically. If I want my site to do well, this is a bullet point now on the list of things that you should do for your site to do well.
And they're saying, Gina, you know, you have a really nice blog there. It'd be a shame if anything happened to
you. It's a stick-shaped carrot, I'm telling you. If you've ever been hit by a carrot, it can hurt.
It's a really big carrot.
It's a really big carrot.
You know what's interesting, though? He says, just below what you were quoting, Leo, he says, our mission is organizing the world's information and making it accessible. And I think we probably missed more of the people part of that than we should have. So an admission that, you know, they're basically playing catch up.
And they still haven't gotten it either. I think what we're hearing from especially Leo is, you know, you haven't engaged me. You haven't engaged my heart.
Nope.
And I think that's where people love it or hate it, but you got to give Zuckerberg, you know, irony of Zuckerberg not being exactly what would seem the Oprah of the world, but he does know how to pluck emotional strings with technology in a way that Google is incapable of doing. And so timeline, you know, yeah, every time you change, it'll be controversial. It's creepy. It's this and that. But I'm, you know, now it's virtually everywhere. I haven't gotten around to mine yet, but it's virtually everywhere, and it does engage you more. It is more human. Facebook is a human company, and that's been Zuckerberg's argument. And Google still is not a human company.
You get a little insight in this interview. Brad Stone does the interview, by the way, did a good job at Business Week. But you get a little insight into why Google Plus is important to Larry with the little Ben Smith analogy he gives. He says, I have a friend named Ben Smith. That's a very common name. For the first time, we're able to say this Ben Smith because we attach a picture to it and content to it. And now you see really what Google Plus is, I think, really all about to Google is that kind of, what do they call it on Wikipedia? Disambiguation.
Yes. Part of the irony is when I go into Facebook and I search for someone who has a name like Ben Smith, there's no, unless I've never found this, there's no way to search for other data points to get the right Ben Smith.
Right. You might get a picture. You'll get a picture
just
of Ben Smith.
A big list.
Yeah. But if there's 100 Ben Smiths, there's no help to me at all. There's no way to do an advanced search, right? Is the chat room going to tell me?
No, you're right.
No, it's true. It's true.
It's a real flaw. It's very hard to find people.
It's interesting, though. Like, that's a search engine problem. And I guess it's a problem that people have. I mean, going back to what Jeff said earlier about Zuckerberg, you know, Zuck really does know, like, what people want. I mean, even if you go back to the early stuff he did in college, like, what he did, like, a hot or not thing where you compared, like, sorority and fraternity guys and girls to one another. And he'd done like a P2P file sharing thing. I mean, he has a good insight, even though he's a little bit maybe robotic, his personality himself. He has good insight into what people really want to do online. And that shows, that's part of why Facebook has been so popular. Also, Facebook has been at this for how many years now? Has it been 10 years? I'm not even sure how old Facebook is. But
it's not.
Six or seven.
Or seven. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, still, that's a long time in internet time.
When I interviewed Zuck for Public Parts Plug, he really sees Facebook as a next step on an evolutionary scale after the Googles. And he says that, you know, where all the real value comes is in the stuff that's in your head. And the only way to get the stuff out of your head willingly is by creating things that are going to make you want to do that, have a reason to do that, want to share. And so he really believes that he's enabling that. And so he sees the value of that humanity. And Google to this day, you know, how do you add humanity to the culture? And I love Google, right? I'm amazed with Google. I think it's a wonderful place, very smart, brilliant. But it is Borgish. Well, that's wrong.
And there was
it is what's the right word? It's robotic.
It's a Python script.
There was a Google engineer who left and talked about Google's rationale, and particularly I think he was talking about Plus. And he said, you know, they don't care about you or as a person and what you want to do. They just want the data.
In some ways, that should reassure people. I mean, if they cared about me, I'd be a little nervous. They wanted to know about me specifically. Wouldn't you? Isn't that what people are really afraid of when they say we're being tracked?
You have to have an insight in what people want in order to make products that are so compelling
instinct.
You can't take your hands off of them, right?
They don't have the instinct.
They don't have that.
They don't have the instinct. It's a bunch
Google
of geeks.
That.
It's a bunch
they
of
geeks. They don't know how people work.
Right.
But, I mean,
is that why Kevin Rose is there?
Maybe. I still can't figure that out.
No.
I mean, I understand why Kevin did it. I don't understand why Google did it.
I love this idea. I can see a huge whiteboard with a gigantic org chart, and there's one box that just says, insert human here.
Yeah. Kevin, congratulations. You're our token human.
Do you need a Don Draper presentation? You know, everybody wants to be loved. To go back to a place where you're loved. Right. How do these products make you feel loved? Let's not say that Google's made some incredible products, Maps and Gmail in particular. Mm-hmm. Gmail never made, you know, makes email awesome. And Maps also still blows my mind to this day. So we shouldn't say blanket carte blanche that they're unable to make really compelling products. It just lately it hasn't felt that way. And Google Plus
and the people who made those things are gone, chased out in effect. The Rasmussen's effectively chased out to Facebook.
And that's
a new one today,
so,
right?
Paul Buchheit.
So Facebook is working on search. You know, they've got a guy from Google. They're going to pour a bunch of resources into search. What does that do? So they're adding search to something that's already a social network. Google's trying to add social to a giant search engine.
Yeah, but Matthew, I'm going to disagree with you there. That I think that only insofar as I think it's dangerous to define the fight in that way. I think when you go to a world where the real aim is, the way I used to put it, is for Google to either of them to intuit your intent. And it's my signals shtick, but it's saying that they want to know what you want before you want it so that they can serve you, hyper serve you. And with both content and advertising and commerce. And so I think it goes beyond Search and social are merely tools toward that higher end. And I go back to the video.
No, I totally agree. But if Facebook has, you know, billions of social signals already, it's got years of sort of building up that expertise.
I agree.
Now it has to apply that better to search. Google's got expertise in search, but they're missing a lot of that social stuff.
Well, and you're right. It's not just the signals about you as an individual, right? Go back to Zuck's favorite phrase, social graph. It's about the relationships. The relationships are what are telling. Mm-hmm. And that's what Facebook understands in a way that Google has not nearly enough. You know, Android will give Google tons more signals about you as an individual. Very valuable signals. Very valuable when it comes to new kinds of advertising and product sales and all kinds of stuff. But it doesn't have really the graph.
And I'm assuming Facebook, you know, they've got engineers that have been working on that social graph and how it works and how it's all connected and how you can infer certain things from it for years now. I mean, Google's got, you know, they've got a lot of smart guys, but that's a totally different game.
Yeah, Twitter, I think, has, you know, if you look at the Twitter hedge fund, it has the finger on the pulse of society more broadly, right? What are we talking about? What's our mood? What's going up? What's going down? Also, who we're connected to and who's seen as authoritative over topics and things like that. Twitter has value here, too. And I wouldn't count them out of this race. They're not going to win any part of this race, but they have their own unique value.
The most interesting part in this interview in Business Week is when Brad Stone asks Larry Page about the Steve Jobs biography. He says, according to the biography, when you became CEO, you went to Jobs for advice. I know you had your differences at the end around Android, but what did you take from him as a mentor and friend? And then Larry says something quite stunning. I think the Android differences were actually for show.
Mm-hmm.
And Brad says, what? The fury around Android was for show? Larry Page says, I think that served their interests. For a lot of companies, it's useful for them to feel like they have an obvious competitor and to rally around that. This is actually exactly the kind of thing Steve Jobs would do. I personally believe it's better to shoot higher. You don't want to be looking at your competitors. You want to be looking at what's possible and how to make the world better.
Ooh.
So it's a little...
Wow.
So he's saying, I don't care what Facebook's doing. I don't care what Twitter's doing.
Because he's worried about what they're going to do.
He says, I personally believe it's better to shoot higher. You don't want to be looking at your competitors. You want to be looking at what's possible and how to make the world better. And for that, we have glasses.
Thermonuclear show.
Yeah. I think it's hysterical that he says that I had a great conversation. Steve was dying. He called me and said, come over. We talked. He says it was for show. And, you know, I could totally see Steve Jobs exactly thinking in the back of his head, yeah, how am I going to get those people to get angry? Ah. Mm-hmm. Go get him.
He did say that he'd use every last one of Apple's resources in order to fight that fight, which does seem ridiculous when framed the way that Larry framed it. I have to say that that quote alone just ratcheted up my respect for him a few notches.
Yeah. Well, that's the right thing to say. Let's hope it's not just lip service. But that's the right
thing to say.
Very, very
savvy thing to say.
And let's not forget, I mean, Google, when you think what products does Google have, Google search is unequivocally the best thing out there still. Despite all of its flaws, and I don't like Search Plus Your World, et cetera, et cetera. Chrome is a great browser.
Chrome is a great product.
It's a great
product.
My Android phone is my favorite phone. I love Android. Now, there have been people who say Google's not got to get control of this brand. It's going to out of control. It's not even their brand anymore, and that may be true, and you may see Google take this Play thing and make it be the Play phone and the Play tablet. Who knows? The Play store. But it's still a great success. If you think about it, it's now half of the smartphones.
Yep.
Out of nowhere.
And your list ain't over yet. Who does email better?
Email, nobody. Gmail's. Well, I will argue with you on that. I know you guys love Gmail. I do not think Gmail webmail is the best webmail experience out there. It's got the ads are annoying. It's kind of quirky. Maybe you guys have gotten used to the fact
priority
that it's not folders, it's lists.
Priority inbox is awesome. And it's IMAP. I mean, it offers IMAP access.
Well, I have an IMAP use. I mean, I love IMAP. But, I mean, there's lots of IMAP services out there.
Absolutely.
I would be dead without Priority Inbox.
Really? Just Google is providing this free service. I mean, for someone, you know, for someone who just doesn't want to set up email, I mean, you can use Gmail with any client. I'm not going to sell Gmail. I do happen to love the web interface and tat and labels and priority inbox.
I know. I'm alone on this one because a lot of people love Gmail. And I think Docs is actually kind of brilliant.
It is. And you haven't even listed Maps yet.
And then building on to what Gina already said about Maps.
Right. Okay.
So they have plenty of... No, products that are first in class, best in class, right? There's no question.
Yep.
Yeah.
So it's not like they're struggling. It's just that there's and I have to say, if you're going to grade Larry on his year, this was the worst year for the creepy factor. It wasn't under Eric Schmidt. It was under Larry Page. Right?
Right.
With the iOS hack, Search Plus My World, the privacy. I mean,
one could argue. I'm not trying to throw Eric under the bus here either. One could argue that those were cultural issues that were probably already brewing.
Maybe. Yeah.
That were not there. But there too, you see, I think it's a PR problem. And I know that sounds, I'm going to get in trouble for saying that. No, it's no, Jarvis, it's more than a PR problem. But I really think so. I put up a piece on the list from GigaOM, in fact, from your colleague, Derek, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wrote a defense of Google on the privacy things and just said, you know, come on, let's get back down to earth. Let's get back down to reality. It's not, you know, this has been way overblown. And I don't want to get, we've had that discussion five times before. I don't want to.
But yeah, I've been saying this for months.
Right. My point here is that what got bungled in this was not the policy, but the execution of the PR strategy, the public strategy about it. They could have turned around and really worked this hard and said, you know, we think it's ridiculous that you have 20 things. We're going to put this out there. We're going to have a time for comment. We're going to do this. They could have made this such a plus, and it turned into a negative because they don't understand. It's the problem with Google and people again. Not that Facebook is any better at those kinds of things. They are in some ways worse. And I don't want to see the PR-ification of the world and everything gets slicked up. There's a different kind of relationship than messaging. That relationship should be collaborative, and it should be open and beta. And they forget their own lessons when it comes to this. And so I think the problem in privacy was not creepiness. The problem was oddly
spin
lackiness. Yeah.
But to use an alternate example, I would argue that Google Search Plus Your World was all PR. Like, it's all spin. I mean, their pitch about it, even the
that's
name,
fair.
Right?
You know. Search plus
because
your world.
It's not
your world. It's search plus the parts of your world that intersect
search
with our
plus
world.
Plus.
Yeah, and I'll buy that, Matthew. Even though I will somewhat defend the thing, I buy that because it did not certainly live up to the company's hype.
Right.
Quite the contrary, it disappointed. Whereas they didn't try to get the expectations up for privacy and deal with that properly. I mean, Gina, you were more obviously negative on that policy than I am. What do you think?
On the privacy policy consolidation?
Substance versus presentation.
Mm.
I actually thought the substance was excellent.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I kept trying to tell people, even on the radio show, this is good.
This is a good thing. Yeah. Yeah, I agree that it was a PR problem, the way that they presented it.
Well, they may not have been in control of this. I mean, it's kind of hard when the entire world and Fox News decide that you're evil. To say, no, we're not evil. Really, we're not evil. Show me another company that has as many services as this, that has a unified privacy policy that's in English that you can understand, gives you an opt-out, gives you a way to take your data out of it.
But when have you heard people say that in Google? I put up a thing today. Somebody in USA Today from Google actually kind of wrote that. And that's the test of writing something simply. It's in USA Today.
Right.
But that's
who they need to talk to.
That's what they have out today. It's on the list under Google.
Yeah, I see it.
And
we protect your data.
They should have been saying that months ago. And now the problem is it's probably too late to make this point.
A search for Google privacy tools points you to a dozen ways to control your information. Yeah, this is good. This is what should have been written. This is from Alma Witten, Google's Director of Privacy for Product and Engineering.
And if you go to the link below that, it's Derek Harris's piece in GigaOM.
Yes.
Which is very good.
Yep.
And just says, let's cut the crap here.
But I've been saying this all along. And I kind of gave up because people This is where it's a problem. I said it, and people get upset at me. Oh, you're a Google fanboy. How dare you, defend them? Everybody knows Google's evil.
So go back to that org chart. Not that Google probably has any. They probably have it in 3D and moving globes.
It's a Python script.
Imagine there's a 2D org chart, right? Where do they need help? They need help in
getting the word out.
True public relations with the public.
And I think that's why you see Larry Page, who doesn't give interviews, finally giving an interview at Business Week.
Way overdue. I think that's part of the responsibility he should have. He has to be the human face of Google. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a great interview also in Business Week. Actually, it's from the 92nd Street Y, where Marissa Meyer, where some great little juicy tidbits. Nothing earth-shattering, but I'm going to share five things you didn't know about Google from that interview in just a second. We're talking about Google, we're talking about Google, the universe, and everything on this episode of This Week in Google with Gina Trapani, Matthew Ingram from GigaOM, and Jeff Jarvis. More in a bit, but first, let's talk about Ford and Sync. You know, I love Sync. I have a Mustang, 2010 Mustang, which I love anyway. Who wouldn't love it? You turn it on, it goes. But it's kind of cool to have a muscle car that looks like it came straight out of, you know, Bullet, 1965. I feel like I'm Steve McQueen driving this thing. And it's got Ford Sync. It's got like the latest 21st century stuff in it. So here's the deal. Ford did a lot of studies, a lot of research. Distracted driving, big issue, right? But people want to be connected. So on the one hand, there's consumers saying, no, we want to be connected to the world. And then there's all this research and government saying, yeah, but distracted driving is very, very, very dangerous. So Ford did the research, and this is what they found. As long as your eyes are on the road and your hands are on the wheel, you have sufficient cognitive resources to listen, to talk. But the key is nothing can pull your attention over down to the console. You can't be fiddling with knobs. Hands on the wheel, eyes on the road. That's why they came up with Sync, which means you tell your car everything. You talk to it. And it's safer because your hands don't leave the wheel. You don't have to look down at a screen. Everything is spoken to you. You can even say, what's my horoscope? And the Sync will tell you. And now they've added this, which I love. It's AppLink. So what they told me, here it is, Ford.com/technology. You can look at it. What they told me is, well, we understand that we're never going to iterate our technology as fast as app developers are iterating their technology on the Android and the iPhone. So what we're going to do is give developers a mobile application developer network. We'll work with them to get their apps on Ford Sync. We'll give you a full API. And that's what AppLink is. It's an API platform that allows Ford and app developers to bring in-vehicle voice control, that Ford Sync, to apps on your phone. You don't have to update the software in the vehicle. You just connect to the phone. Now, it started with Pandora, and you had all the Pandora controls in voice. Thumbs up, thumbs down, next station, play my Rolling Stone station, that kind of thing. Then there was OpenBeak. You could read tweets. There was Slacker Radio for podcasts, Stitcher for podcasts. Now they've got iHeartRadio, and it supports their ThumbPlay service. So you're listening. You say, I want to hear KFI. Your saved stations, you just pull them up by name. We could skip to the next song when you're listening to their radio, their music, you know, their Pandora thing. You can give a song a thumbs up. NPR has breaking news now. You say, I want to hear All Things Considered. I want to hear This American Life. Boom. Boom. Actually, I don't know if This American Life's on it. Because that's another public radio system. They got to get this together. And they have this destinations thing, Sync Destinations, which is an app on your phone. So you could take the phone's navigation and bring it to the car. I mean, this is it's simple. It's obvious once I say it. Make an API so the car's computer can talk to the phone apps, and then your hands stay on the wheel, your eyes are on the road, and yet you have the world at your fingertips, and it's updated. This is so slick. Try it. Go to a Ford dealer. Drive one today. There's mine, unfortunately, does not have AppLink, but all the new Fords do. Tell the Ford dealer you want to take a look at AppLink. They'll give you a demo. Or visit Ford.com/technology. They've got the videos on there and more. Pretty cool stuff. Ford.
You know, wasn't there a car once like the Google Glasses projected info onto?
There still are. There are a number of cars. Audi does that. I think Mercedes has a heads-up display. Yeah. Audi has something that is really wild. They have night vision, and they'll project pedestrians. I think I'm told this. They'll project pedestrians on the screen. They had at CES, they were there, and they had like a simulator with hydraulics, so you'd like think you were in the car and you'd be driving around. And they showed if you drift out of a lane. It's kind of, the car stuff is very interesting. But I have to say, not all these manufacturers have the same focus on distracted driving. I was stunned because Mercedes said, whoa, we're putting Facebook in Mercedes. All you have to do is turn a knob and pick the message you want to send, your status message, and push the button. Oh, that's a good idea. Is it that important?
Well, it would make an episode of Glee.
Jeez.
A cliffhanger.
Oh, yes. A car crash that's cliffhanger, exactly.
Yeah. Smart.
So it really is important, and that's where I think Alan Mulally and his team are really doing a lot. And this is not the Ford ad anymore, but I think they're really thinking.
Yeah, you got this responsibility.
There's a huge responsibility, and you know, one of the things they're terrified about, they don't want the government to suddenly say, "Oh, by the way, you can't talk on the phone anymore in your car." I mean, there is that risk that if they do not take this, is always true. If they don't take it in hand and really be responsive, that they'll be forced to, and then maybe in a way that's not, that consumers don't like and the companies don't like. So
have you seen the new proposed standards?
Yes, the NTSB does not want you talking on the phone.
Right. So there's new standards that cut down all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Oh damn, I can't find them right now. But a whole new set of standards that would cut down what you're allowed to do in the car.
Right.
What car manufacturers can give you.
Right.
It's scary because just as they get more sophisticated, they'll get dumbed down.
Right.
And it's interesting, you know, we were looking at the Google Glasses and how, to some extent, a heads-up display makes a lot of sense, especially if you're trying to follow directions or you're trying to, you know, get information without looking down so you walk into things. That,
right.
That's even more the case when you're driving. The more information you can get that's overlaid on the road while you're driving, the less you have to look away.
Yeah, heads-up is cool.
Of course, I predict within 2 years it will be illegal to wear your Google Glasses.
Oh, yeah, nobody's going to let you wear Google Glasses.
But
and then within 5 years, there'll be calls to outlaw it while walking. Then the absurdity of that will be made clear to the staff that proposes it.
Yeah.
It will create a little bit of an isolating experience, though. You know, like when headphones, you know, you go on any college campus, everyone's walking across campus with headphones in and people don't greet one another or talk as much.
If
everyone's kind of sucked into their heads-up display, it also, you know, creates this other layer of isolating.
I'm telling you, there is a risk. This is the problem, is that we as geeks, we want this. We don't want to see people.
Right.
We want to see virtual people.
We're conforming the world to our own introverted notions. You know,
the show is not called This Week in People.
Get the people out of here. So five things. Go ahead.
Imagine if you had sonar.me or Highlight or something like that integrated into your glasses. It could tell you when someone was nearby that you might want to talk to.
Do not.
Or Gina's.
Or girls
nightmare.
Around me.
Yeah. Girls around me. What did you think about that, huh? Ay, is that creepy?
Gina, you first. You tweeted brilliantly on it.
So, I mean, the whole point of Foursquare and location services is that you can find other people. I accept that. But Girls Around Me was an iPhone app, which I don't think exists anymore, or at least Foursquare
killed it. Foursquare pulled the API, and then Apple killed the app.
And then Apple killed the app. Girls Around Me would launch, and you'd see this lovely radar screen with the silhouette of naked women kind of dancing on the radar, and would let you, and would show you people who registered on Facebook as female and their photos and all their history. So it was a way to find women, girls, quote unquote, around you. And I had a serious problem, not with the premise of the app, which is finding people near you, because that's a premise to Foursquare, and I use that.
Or look at Highlight, which does exactly the same
thing. Or Highlight, same thing, but it was the design. It was clearly weaponized design. It was like stalkers here, you know, stalkers come download this app here. So that was the problem that I had, because a lot of people said, hey, you know, this is the whole point about Foursquare, is to find people nearby. I don't think there's a problem with that. It was the fact that this app was designed shamelessly and clearly designed for people who were, you know, there are chicks checking in near you. I mean, this was like the actual ad copy.
But that was really what it was, is that they were tone deaf designers. You know, I mean, that look, Mark Zucker.
And this is something that Zuck may have built when he was in college.
Let me tell you something. Mark Zuckerberg made Facebook to get laid.
Oh.
And people use Facebook. That's the primary reason people use Facebook, is they want to meet people of the other, you know, that they're interested. I won't say opposite sex, of the people that they're interested in.
Right.
That's the primary purpose of it still. But Zuck had the good sense to obfuscate that.
To make it
right.
To make it
right.
It is
right.
And it
but
is
the problem
about
is. it only takes one bozo to ruin it, right? This is a classic case. The piece that I put on this from O'Reilly by Mike, if I get this right, Lucidides. A good and reasoned piece about it, saying that, yeah, you might want to find car repair people around you or geeks around you or hackers around you or other people around you. The functionality works. The problem is one person does this, and then someone's going to come along and try to outlaw every possible use of the same technology because one person
right.
could do something bad. And that's the world that we're in right now.
I just did a search for the app and one of the latest news, if you just read the headline right here.
Our app's not for stalking them, and it's for avoiding the ugly ones. See, it tone deaf. See, tone deaf. That was exactly it. It was tone deaf. They didn't get it.
They didn't. I mean, it was beyond tone deaf. It was full on misogynist. I mean, just the title, girls. I mean, they were talking about women because an app that actually showed you girls, and I define a girl as someone who hasn't menstruated yet, that would be illegal. Okay. So the whole thing, sorry, I didn't mean to go into a girls around me rant. Wow. The whole thing was just these guys are idiots. I mean,
there's that larger point, which is it's not doing something that these apps weren't intended to do.
No.
Right.
But it just was blatant about it.
It was blatant about it was bad intentioned. It was clearly bad intentioned.
I disagree. And the intention is always the same intention.
Well, it's
wasn't it out for like almost a year? I mean, it had been around for a long time.
It had been around.
Do you
for
remember
a long time.
Gawker Stalker, Gina? Were you at Gawker when Gawker Stalker?
Yes, I do.
But Gina, do you have a problem with Grindr?
No, I don't.
It's exactly the same purpose.
But Grindr, you are signing in for that purpose. You're using Grindr only for that purpose.
Ah, you're right. You're right. You're opting into being grinded.
You're telling your buddies where you are, and this place is using it for a purpose. And that's the argument in the O'Reilly piece. Helen Nissenbaum, who's being very influential right now in privacy, talks about context. Mm-hmm. And it's a good concept, but I find it almost impossible to imagine an execution in all these cases. So, but the argument in this case was, if you're using Grindr, the context is very clear. Yes. You are getting laid because that's why you signed in to do it.
Right.
Whereas you're giving Facebook data to tell your buddies and your family where you are, and then it's being used in this terrible way, and it violates the context.
So their real mistake was just not making a heterosexual Grindr.
I had a student...
There's a couple out there already.
Oh, really?
In fact, I had a student who taught me about Grindr who found his straight friends were amazed at this. And so his business for my class, it's too bad he didn't do it, was going to do that early on.
Straight Grindr, yeah.
Yeah.
There's one called Tingle, I think it is.
Ooh, I like that.
Ooh,
give me a Tingle. Oh.
Yeah, I mean, any dating site, right, where you say, come by. I mean, Grindr works particularly well. The target demo is gay men, right?
Yes, right.
Right. So, I mean, that's a really good demographic for opting into,
It's pretty safe.
You know
what
I mean?
It's a safe bet.
I won't go into queer politics here or whatever. But
those guys are pigs.
They like to hook up.
No, stop. I think we've made the point. Let's move on. I really want to do... Go ahead, Matt. Go ahead.
Sorry. Just one thing. I thought Jeff... You know, Helen Nissenbaum makes a really good point about context. Yes. How we do it is a lot more complicated, but I think her point is good.
When I wrote a public parts plug, I struggled with that because a lot of people admire Helen. I admire her too. She's very smart. She's at NYU. I read her book, and every argument makes sense, but then I cannot imagine the execution of it. I mean, you can, but that's what actually taught me. So I turned it around using Dana Boyd, and this is the point that Tim O'Reilly makes in the piece on O'Reilly, is that it's about the use, not the gathering of the data. It's about the behavior, not the technology. And so the way I learned from it was to turn it around and say that you can't probably make a law or regulations that can anticipate context. So they can't anticipate everything.
Right.
But you can have an ethical standard that says to these guys, come on, you know this is evil, this is wrong, it's misusing context.
Well, and I think that's exactly what happened.
Exactly.
They got
smacked. So it worked in this case. It didn't work from regulation. It didn't work from legislation.
Right.
It worked from
that's
norms.
Mores.
Society
yes.
saying,
mm-hmm.
We just saw a new line and you're a mile over it, bozo.
Yeah.
Get back.
And the chat room suggesting, and I think this is going to be my next app, Bacon Around Me. Now that I'd spend money for. I just want to go home now. Let's all just go home and take a shower, all right?
It's time to eat.
It's time to eat. Bacon.
No, I'm hungry.
Five things you didn't know about Google, and then we'll get your picks and tips and so forth. Marissa Meyer, I wish I'd seen this. 92nd Street Y is great, where people really go and they talk. And she spent 90 minutes talking with Josh Tyrangiel of Business Week. Tyrangiel. Terengel? I don't know. He and Mike Lukaitis can just get together and figure out how to say their names. Google Basics white homepage wasn't an ode to minimalism. It was pure necessity, said Marissa Meyer. We don't have a webmaster, and I don't do HTML, Sergey Brin is famous for saying. It's simple because I can't do anything fancier. Marissa Meyer almost killed the idea of targeting ads against users' email because she thought it was creepy. A colleague knew.
But she now is embarrassed that she even thought that.
So she was right. A colleague working on an all-nighter ignored her and, of course, created AdSense. Whoops. Google has calculated that an ad on its homepage would cost at least $10 million. But it's not for sale. This is one that just shocked me. Most Google pages sport a small copyright notice at the bottom. Why? Not because it's necessary.
I like that.
But it turned out, when they tested it, that users would just stare at the homepage, waiting for the rest of it to load. Right. And we're so conditioned that once the copyright loads, it's all done. So they put a copyright.
That's my favorite anecdote.
Brilliant.
It's done. You can now you click.
And that came from user testing. Right. That came from showing the pages again and again and again to people.
Just love that. All right. Time, my friends. There's lots more. Facebook threatening to sue a commenter on TechCrunch. but let's move on.
Yeah, I mentioned just one thing. There's a really good piece in, believe it or not, the current issue of Vanity Fair. About the war over the net. We can talk about it next week.
I love Vanity Fair. What do you mean, believe it or not?
Well, it's not exactly doing, compete with Wired.
It's a good piece.
That's all I mean. It's a very good piece that goes on about the war over the net that's coming, the dangers to the net.
Cool.
Expresses it very well, I think.
Is it a Tim Wu kind of a thing? Or
No, it's more of a political
about
piece.
The UN.
UN.
They want to take control over.
Just efforts to control the net. Yeah. And so I just recommend it for reading. It's for discussion next week.
And also, we should mention this, that Starbucks, right now you get a Google offer deal, $5 for $10 at Starbucks.
Yeah, but $3 goes to creating jobs, apparently.
Oh, I was just thinking about the money. Okay. Yeah. So it's good for job
the economy
stuff.
Yeah, it's good for the economy. Go to Starbucks.
It's good for the economy.
Not too.
Starbucks gift cards can be used to participate. You know, I have a Starbucks card. I wonder if I could use this to add more dollars to it. Yeah, I guess so, probably.
Yeah, you're probably going to get a gift card, yeah.
Yeah. $5 for $10 gift card. And $3 goes to jobs. Nothing wrong with jobs.
Steve.
Not Steve. Some other jobs. Jobs for USA.
Jobs in the U.S.
Jobs in the U.S.
Leo, have you been talking on Twitter? I missed this week's episode about the jobs bill, the investment.
You know, we didn't, and we should. It's very close to passing. It's passed both houses and of the Congress, and now just awaits President Obama's signature, right?
Yes, yeah.
Signed tomorrow, I think.
And jobs does not stand for jobs, actually, oddly enough. What does it stand for? I'll look it up. It's I hate these acronyms. They're so funny. Jumpstart Our Business Startups Act. Now, here's the thing. That it's overturning what I thought were quite reasonable restrictions that were designed to keep suckers from being taken by con men, getting them to invest in stuff.
Well, that's what Andrew Ross Sorkin tried to say in the Times, and I think he's right to an extent that there are controls that are necessary. Though
this was a safety net.
Yeah, but
he used
there's
Groupon
two
as an example. They wouldn't even be covered.
Right.
But as Henry Blodgett said, it's not the SEC's job. I mean, listen, any idiot could know that Groupon was a bad investment. And then, unfortunately, there were a lot of people who were idiots and invested in it. I was screaming it. Others were screaming it. It was a bad investment. And you can't stop people from investing in bad companies. Now, the separate issue is, if you have a fraudulent company, if you're in penny stock land and it's just plain old crap, and that comes broadly, that's an issue. But we have a big problem with capital in the country, right, and startups to be able to enable, one, early liquidity, and two, to enable, you know, a Kickstarter of equity, which is what the low end of this bill does. I didn't mean to get into a whole discussion. But I think it's an important thing for where we go in the entrepreneurial investment in the country, and it's going to be important to what we cover on Twit and Twig and such.
I'm glad you brought it up, because in fact we hadn't really had this conversation. This would be the best place to do it.
And it actually sounds to me as though it's sort of two bills in one, in a way, or there's a good part and a bad part. And the good part, or what most people agree is the good part, is that it encourages crowdfunding. It allows you to raise smaller amounts of money from more people, and that's all good. And then there's another part of the bill that kind of scales back some of the regulatory stuff that companies would have to face, you know, filings and proving that they're not scams. And so a lot of people like the one part, but not the other part. But they're married together in one bill.
Yeah, disclosure rules like Sarbanes-Oxley are loosened a little bit for small companies.
For certain companies. Under $1 billion.
Right.
And Groupon is over, so actually wouldn't be part of this.
It also is kind of for Facebook, because Facebook, remember, had to, once it had, I think it was 200, 500. Investors, it had to file for public. Now it can go, what is it, 1,000?
2,000.
Some of these things were modernizing. We're merely modernizing. And Steve and Case, who was the guy who put this through, really, the former founder of AOL, made the point that, look, you can be an idiot and go to a casino and lose unlimited amounts of money. We don't protect people from casinos. Why are we protecting people from investing in startups? And things like Kickstarter, look, I got taken on Kickstarter. I keep getting taken on Kickstarter. But, you know, it's a small amount of money. And it's huge for jump-starting the economy.
And it is restricted to $10,000 or no more than 10%.
Yeah, your liability is limited. There's in the UK, this is encouraged to the extent there's even tax breaks around this kind of crowdsourced investment.
Great.
A company called Escape the City, Mikey Howe is one of the founders, and he was nice enough to send an email saying they were partly inspired by what would Google do, plug. But they just put it out there because they could in the UK, and I just got an update from him today. And he said that 2,200 members have pledged, and they won't actually raise all this, but they've pledged $15 million in investment in the company. Hmm. And so when it comes time to actually get the investment, you know, that's fairly safe. So, Gina, what I want to ask you is, you're now, God bless you, a capitalist and part of a for-profit venture.
Yes.
How would you look at investment from crowdsourcing and members and a whole bunch of small people, like, you know, kind of Obama fundraising, versus angels, friends and family, and venture funds?
Yeah, certainly. It would certainly be a possibility for us. I think the Kickstarter model is amazing. I also have had projects not send me anything in the end, but also seen some great projects come through. And it's definitely something that we would, you know, that we would consider. I don't want to speak for Anil, but, you know, we're trying to raise funding kind of in a smart way, get good money, like the night application, for example. So, you know, that's something I would love, you know. It could be beneficial to us, and I think in a lot of different startups. So,
and it seems funny to me that you can raise money for a new iPod dock or iPad stand, or someone can raise $2 million for back issues of comic books or something, but you can't use the same model for a startup technology company. It just doesn't make any sense.
So our consensus is this is a good thing. Be careful, but it's basically a good idea.
Be careful out there.
Good, because it's going to be law tomorrow. By the way, today's the day, and I don't know if we've heard yet, that Yahoo's laying off 1 million people.
2,000.
The letter is out.
It's just a start.
Yep. It's just a start.
Plenty more where they came from.
Plenty more there. And there's a really great stupid game on the front page of the New York Times. I can't stop playing it. It doesn't do anything.
It's a story about stupid games, but I couldn't read the story. I never got to the
story.
TFDR, too much fun, don't read.
Is this the first time there's been a game on the New York Times webpage?
Remember way back when the original Pong ad on Wired?
Whoa.
As an ad.
Yeah.
Oh.
You can blow up ads. Oh, this is great.
I wish the best exotic marigold disappeared.
The best joke I saw on Twitter was can you use it to blow through the paywall?
Let's find out.
Have you guys seen NYT on it? This Twitter account?
Yes.
I love it.
Brilliant.
It's NYT on it?
Brilliant. NYT
on it.
They
took all these fake trend stories.
The tweet on this story was, guys, Angry Birds is very addictive and the Times is on it.
So everything has to end with the Times is on it?
Yeah, everything when they find a fake trend story.
Or they write it trending years later after everybody.
Guys, apparently clothing really does make the man, and the New York Times is on it. And these are actual stories.
Go to the one about the iPhone cases.
Yeah, people like to put colorful iPhone cases on their iPhones, and the New York Times is on it.
Oh, this is so funny.
Brilliant.
New York City apartments don't always have dishwashers, and that Times is on it.
Oh, my God. This is hysterical.
Very funny. Recommend.
Guys, sports fans cheer for the home team and mock the visitors. The Times is on it. Guys, puppies are now an acceptable part of any wedding party, and the Times is on it. Wow, this is very funny.
They have so much to choose from.
It's kind of material. It's kind of natural.
Write it itself.
Follow. The problem is I follow so many great things like that that so my Twitter feed is useless. But fun. All right. So I think we've now covered everything that I can't get out of this stupid game, unfortunately. I can't close this window. All right. There we go. Stupid game done. Google surveys. Do we want to talk about the consumer surveys?
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's neat. I should have made this my tool.
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
I don't think the data coming through that is going to be that useful, but maybe that's just me. I mean, I think I just was in an airport and I filled out a survey so I could get free Wi-Fi. I just clicked things randomly until it said, okay, you can have Wi-Fi now.
I'm going to make a survey. Is the New York Times on it? Anyway, so you can see this is just Google surveys. If that's not a recursive search that will get you in a loop, and there you go. Oh, and there's a visualization.
Eileen,
you're funny. 1 hour per second.com, a visualization of how many videos are being uploaded to YouTube every second.
You just got me hungry talking about bacon, so I'm ready for lunch. Mm-hmm. Sorry.
It's a pretty okay. Just yes. Go to 1 hour per second.com. It's kind of
1 hour per second.com. Yeah. If you click there, it kind of translates what that means.
Yeah. Let's visualize that. Again, somebody's 20% time going to a complete waste of time.
And now we're going to get bumped off YouTube.
No, I didn't play it. I didn't do it. All right. Gina's tip of the week.
So people who watch Twit probably heard about this weekend, but I just absolutely couldn't resist because it was so cool. It was an April Fool's gag. It's 8-bit Google Maps, which is still up. You can still get to it. I think it's maps.google.com, and you have to give it a parameter like UTM campaign 8-bit. But it's really neat. You can zoom and pan around the world. It's all 8-bit, and there's a ton of Easter eggs in there. There's a UFO abducting a cow in Area 51. There's the Loch Ness Monster. There's Bigfoot. So I included a link to some of the Easter eggs throughout. If you didn't see it this weekend, if it was a Sunday and you're spending it with your family instead of looking at all the online April Fool's gags, this one.
It was pretty amazing
really
that
cool.
They did this. I mean, Street View and 8-bit. I mean, that's awesome.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Very cool. Jeff, your number of the week.
Well, just relevant to what we talked about earlier with the glasses we all want. Hint. Google Maps now covers 75% of global population, which, again, it gives context as to why are they doing some of this stuff? Why is Maps so important to them besides the fact that it's a good service? If you want to be able to walk people around, by the nose, then having good maps around the world is important, and it has value. If you want to have self-driving cars, having great maps is important. So Maps just keeps growing and growing and growing.
That's amazing, isn't it?
They need to attach cameras to postal trucks.
As long as we have them.
There you go. We've been looking for something like that.
Sorry, Matt.
Self-driving postal trucks.
I was just going to say, I noticed over the last little while a bunch of startups not using Google Maps anymore.
Yes.
And using OpenStreetMap and stuff like that.
Even Apple. Mm-hmm. Using OSM data. I like OSM. Yeah. OpenStreetMaps. This was going to be, is that your number? Are you done?
I'm done.
Are we done with the number? This was, my tool is something that no one can use, but it's something we've been waiting for. We had heard that Hearst, Time, and Condé Nast would do some sort of Netflix for magazines. It's now out, but you have to have a Honeycomb or better tablet. So all 12 of you watching who have that can I've actually already paid for this. It's $15 a month, but you get, you know, a bunch of titles. Essence, Fitness, Esquire, Entertainment, Glamour, In Style, Money. I mean, you know, and so you can read New Yorker. You can read at Vanity Fair, Time. So you can read any of these, right? Unlimited.
Okay, I want to hear back from you in 2 months how many articles you actually read.
Well, that's the thing. For $15 a month, most of these magazines are $10 or $15 a year. That's, you could get, a 10 magazines. So pick the 10 you like.
How often do you read magazines now?
No, I don't read magazines. I get the New Yorker on my iPad, and I don't look at it.
How often do you read it?
Never. Occasionally, there'll be something good.
Never.
This is their last attempt, right, at saving
magazines.
They have unlimited basic. Get unlimited access to dozens of the top magazines for just $9.99 a month. Great for the whole family. Then get everything in the unlimited basic plan, plus unlimited access to weeklies, including New Yorker, People, Sports, Illustrated, and more for just $14.99 a month. So I guess I got the weekly plan, but it's free for the first month. So you're right. I'll keep it for a month.
And let's report back.
And I'll report back on whether I do this. And I only and it's only for tablets with a resolution of 1024 by 600. Not greater than, not less than, exactly.
Huh.
And that's the New Yorker, by the way. It's the only one. That's bizarre. It's not even on the iPad. It's not even that. So I don't know what they're talking about. It's basically broken. I'm sure Jeff would have something pithy to say about the end of print.
That's all there is to say about print.
Matthew, great to have you. Matthew Ingram, editor at gigaohm.com. Great to have you. Please.
Is he frozen?
Come back. Well, he's thinking.
It's a good
he's
pose. Thinking.
He's got boxing gloves, so I'll call him the pugnacious.
Sphinx-like.
Stillness. Matthew Ingram. He's contemplative. He's meditating.
That's very Canadian of him.
Om. That's what they call it, gigaohm.
Gigaohm. That's right. Hit the time.
Om. Jeff Jarvis, he is a journalism professor at the City University of New York. Those lucky kids, also the blogger at buzzmachine.com and the author of a book you must read called Public Parts if you want to understand what's happening in the future. Gina Trapani at smarterware.org, thinkupapp.com, and just wonderful person. Thank you.
Live long and prosper, Leo.
Live long and prosper. Jeff Clavier is joining us on Triangulation this afternoon, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, 2300 UTC. Jeff is a very interesting angel capitalist who has some very interesting ideas about the startup economy. And, of course, we'll ask him about jobs. I'm sure he'll have something to say about that as well. We do this show every Wednesday, 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern, 2000 UTC at twit.tv. Watch live or we make audio and video available after the fact. You can always download it. Just subscribe, though, so that you make sure you get every episode on iTunes and all the better subscription places. That's about it. Thanks to Eileen Rivera, our producer. Thanks to you for joining us. Yes. Thanks to Ayaz Akhtar for performing background duties and keeping his glasses clean.
Yay. Thanks, Ayaz.
Thanks, you guys.
It was a little weird the other day. He wasn't there. It was like, what the hell?
I know. That was Sunday.
He doesn't come in on Sunday. What the hell?
Missing.
Yeah, what's missing? And thanks to Betty Francis for making me look thin.
Oh, man.
Little Mad Men reference in there. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.